The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Werke, Judge Bryan. The Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. The second case on our oral calendar this morning is court file 821-0289, State of Minnesota versus Blas Palma Alvarado. The matter is here for oral argument. Everyone is appearing via Zoom. We thank you for that. But our rules are the same, as you know, which means that each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, should you wish to exercise that. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourselves for our record here. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Sharon Jackson. I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Blas Palma Alvarado and his challenge to his assault conviction. His conviction arose out of a fight between him and Jose Quintero that occurred outside of Mr. Palma's apartment building after Mr. Quintero had assaulted him at least once. The critical issue at trial was, did he or did he not act in self-defense? Today, I'd like to focus on the first issue in appellant's brief, and that is whether Mr. Palma was denied a fair trial due to the prosecutor using an inadmissible duplicate of a partial video of the altercation between the two men to persuade the jury that Mr. Palma did not act in self-defense. That duplicate was inadmissible for a couple of reasons. First, it wasn't authenticated. The case law is very clear that to authenticate a duplicate, the proponent has to show that it was made using a technique that was designed to ensure the accuracy of the reproduction of the original. And here, the state didn't present any evidence of that. There was conflicting evidence as to which camera was used. Was it a body camera? Was it a camera on the officer's telephone? Was it another camera? There was no evidence as to the reliability of the camera. There was no evidence as to the circumstances under which the camera was used here, how close it was to the original, what the lighting was. There was basically zero evidence on this point.
Didn't two witnesses testify that the duplicate that was played to the jury was an accurate reproduction of the security video that was taken at the apartment building? And if that's so, why isn't that sufficient?
That's right, Flory. Judge Flory, there were two witnesses that testified as such, the maintenance director as well as the officer. That's not enough because that is the standard that is required for authenticating an original, not a duplicate. For a duplicate, under State versus Brown, the proponent has to show that the method that was used to make the duplicate was designed to ensure its accuracy. And here, the state didn't present any evidence of that.
So what would have been required from your point of view? Some sort of expert testimony or in order to sufficiently authenticate it? I'm just wondering what you think should have been done to...
At the point that the objection was made, the state was required to bring in testimony from the officer with respect to what camera that the officer had used, whether or not that camera had been used in the past, had he known that camera to be reliable, as well as the circumstances surrounding how he made this particular, how he took this particular image, how close he was to the original, perhaps what the lighting was that day. I don't know that in this particular circumstance, like in Brown, an expert would have been required. But what the state presented here was absolutely nothing. And furthermore, in order for the duplicate to be admissible, the state was also required to show it wouldn't be unfair to the defense.
Before you get to the fairness argument, I guess my concern is that if I look at the Brown case, it seems that the circumstances of that copy or that duplicate are pretty different than what we have here. And there are times potentially where you have someone giving testimony about something that they viewed, or you have an audio recording of someone watching another video. And it seems that those are different. Those aren't duplicates or reproductions or copies in the same way that we were dealing with in Brown. So do you think there's any category of a video recording of another video that wouldn't be subject to the analysis in Brown?
I don't, Judge Bryan. I would agree with you that they are, the circumstances are distinguishable in the sense that, as I acknowledged, I don't think this is a situation where you would need an expert. But I think, as you know, the rule is very clear that there has to be some authentication, and just saying I took a picture isn't adequate. I think that bears out in the state's own concession that it was of very poor quality. So, you know.
Right, but before we get to the poor quality piece, because I think that's more about the weight that it might be given as opposed to authenticity here, I also see in Brown the requirement that there be a challenge to the authenticity of the original video. In other words, the arguments presented to us are more about whether or not the I'll call it the atrium video versus the body camera. The arguments are about the body camera, not about the authenticity of the original video. And so it seems like under that first part of Brown, you've conceded that there is no challenge to the authenticity of the original video, and therefore we're looking at the fairness side instead.
Well, we certainly haven't conceded that. I mean, that is certainly a third reason why the duplicate is unauthenticated. I mean, it's hard to challenge the authenticity of the original when we don't have the original. There certainly was no testimony about the original. But
right, but if I look at the briefing, it seems like, especially in the reply brief, you're not challenging the original video. And you're actually saying that the state is arguing something that you're not arguing when they address the authenticity of the original video. So it seemed to me, as I reviewed your arguments, that you're not challenging that original video. You're only challenging the body camera.
We affirmatively make arguments expressly as to the duplicate and the fairness. But, you know, it's not that we're not also challenging that. It's just that it wasn't the original wasn't available apparently, or it exists somewhere, and no one went and got it.
Again, but that's more like a best evidence rule, or perhaps some argument that you make in terms of the rule of completeness side of things. But as I look at the arguments, I don't see. Maybe you can point me to some place in your brief where you say that the original video has an authenticity problem. I see it below. I see it below. In the trial below, there's an argument because of the gaps in time and the jumping, if you will, from one time to another. But that seems to be adequately explained in the testimony, and as is the basis for both witnesses saying that this is a fair and accurate depiction of the original video. So it seemed to me that whatever attempt to challenge the authenticity of the original atrium video was made and addressed below, but not appealed.
Well, this is what I would say, Judge Bryan, to that. We focused our argument based on the language in Brown. And Brown, and I have it here before me, says, unless there is a genuine question as to the authenticity of the original, or unfairness in the admission of the digital, it is a properly authenticated duplicate is admissible. And so we focused our argument on the fact that it is unfair to not.
Okay, so let me make it clear, because it seems like Brown sets up two parts. The first part requires a challenge to the original, and you're making an argument under the second part, fairness only. Is that right?
We're making the argument under fairness, and also there's a third part to Brown that says it's only a properly authenticated duplicate that can be admitted. So perhaps we're reading what Brown requires differently.
No, I think we read it the same way. I just wanted to make it clear that it seemed that there were two conditions. An or is the word that brings them together, and you're focusing now more on the fairness side of it rather than challenging the authenticity of the original Atrium video. Okay, thank you.
That's exactly what we're doing. And the reason we set it up as two, both fairness and the authentication of the duplicate is because in our view, Brown has that third condition because the duplicate is only admissible if it's an authenticated duplicate. And then we jump to the rule 1003 on how do you authenticate a duplicate? So focusing then on the fairness for context, what the video shows is Mr. Palma leaving his apartment building with a knife and walking very quickly, swinging his arms towards something off camera, which we can assume or has been argued it is Mr. Quintero. There is then a big gap in the video. And at that point, then you see Mr. Quintero chasing Mr. Palma, kicking Mr. Palma, punching Mr. Palma, and Mr. Palma desperately trying to get away. So the state uses the first part of the video to say Mr. Palma was the aggressor and the stabbing must have occurred right then when he came out of the apartment building because there were some droplets of blood in the general area. In contrast, the defense focuses on the end of the video or the mid portion of the video that shows Mr. Quintero's attack of him to argue that he is in fact not the aggressor, but that he attempted to escape and could not. Now, the one last thing that the defense points to is the fact that there is no blood on the knife after the point at which the state says that the stabbing potentially occurred. And it was unfair then for this video to have been admitted instead of the original because the state in its rebuttal argues that the video is of such poor quality, we can't tell if there's blood or not. So the state is relying on the fact that the duplicate is of poor quality. And we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. It's not just what the state's argument is. It's that we know that the original was available. We know that the maintenance director had offered to get it for the officer. We know that the officer chose not to do that. He openly acknowledged that. We know there was an objection and the prosecutor did not go back to the officer and tried to get the original.
Did the defense ever subpoena the third party here to get the video themselves directly?
You know, I do not know. There is no record of that. And so while certainly the defense would have the opportunity to do that, A, we don't know if they did or not. B, if there's certainly a lay witness would be much more apt to respond to the police than to the defense. And finally, what the defense did do is make an objection. And at that point...
Well, I understand. I guess let's assume that there's error. Let's assume that either under our plain error standard or that there's error, we're still looking at the prejudice side. And I think there's case law that suggests if there were alternative means for the defense to get the same evidence, doesn't that affect our prejudice analysis? And not that you make an objection, okay, fine. So now let's assume that preserves that, but that's not the same as the prejudice side. So isn't it an appropriate thing for us to look at? And as the appellant, isn't it your burden to show that it was not available?
Well, on the prejudice side, we look to, you know, I do not know of case law that indicates that. I do know that the general harmless error or substantial rights inquiry is how did the wrongful admission of the piece of evidence impact the verdict? That's the analysis. It's an impact analysis. And so what we look at is that the state had an extremely weak case to rebut self-defense before the video came in, because what they had was their one witness who gave multiple conflicting stories, most of which indicated that the stabbing occurred significantly after Mr. Palma having left the building. Their witness, Mr. Quintero, was on methamphetamine at the time. He was under the influence and he had a history of aggression towards Mr. Palma. In fact, he had assaulted him just minutes before he went into his apartment. That was 8 to 10 minutes before the stabbing. And so we have that. And then on the defense side, consistent statements from Mr. Palma that he acted in self-defense. There were no other witnesses. And so the state's evidence was weak at best, and that's probably why the state didn't even try to make an argument here that the admission didn't impact Mr. Palma's right to a fair trial. So based on, you know, assuming that it is there, as you say, I think it's that it's uncontroverted that it impacted the verdict here. And it's for these reasons that we would ask the court to reverse and remand for a new trial. I have nothing further unless you have further questions.
Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Jacks. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. Appellant now argues for the first time on appeal that the district court abused its discretion when it admitted a video of the altercation during which he stabbed the victim because it was a copy and because the copy was not properly authenticated.
This Mr. Smith, let me jump in because I don't see below the Rule 103 issue being raised the way it is on appeal. I don't see the Brown case being argued below like it is on appeal. But doesn't that just mean we're applying a plain error standard of review? And if so, maybe you can address under that standard how we would look at the fairness piece, because it seems that that's now the sole reason under Brown that they're articulating that this was inadmissible.
I certainly agree, Judge Bryan, that the Rule 1003 issue was not raised below and addressed square on. Brown wasn't cited in the defendant's motion in limine. We would be here on a plain error review had appellant actually made a plain error argument. And I think that's particularly noteworthy here. Appellant could have, given the fact that that the primary authority she relies on and the actual argument she's making, I'm sorry, the actual argument he's making was not made below, could have and should have made a plain error argument in his principal brief. He failed to do so. And in failing to do so, he's now waived plain error review.
So you're saying that if somebody asserts error on appeal, but does it under the abuse of discretion standard as opposed to plain error review, that they've completely waived this issue, forfeited or waived the issue because they called it abuse of discretion instead of plain error?
That by itself might not get you there, but I think we need to go one step further here. Even after the state raised the issue of plain error in its principal brief, appellant in his reply brief made no argument about the fourth prong of the plain error test. And therefore,
okay, but what case says that you waive the issue entirely if you characterize it under abuse of discretion instead of plain error review on appeal?
I can't draw to mind the name of a particular case, but the case law is clear that arguments that are not made in an appellant's principal brief are waived. And plain error is a separate substantive argument. It's not merely a standard of review argument. It shifts the burden on all aspects of the error test to the defendant. And in particular, it has a fourth prong that appellant has now not argued even after the plain error, the possible applicability of the plain error standard was brought to appellant's attention by the state. The appellant had a reply brief and could have made an argument about the fourth prong. And absent an argument about the fourth prong, that the error seriously affected the integrity or fairness of judicial proceedings writ large, not simply this trial, but judicial proceedings writ large, there can't be a reversal. And it's the appellant who has the burden of demonstrating all of the prongs of the plain error test. And if you haven't made an argument on one of the necessary prongs of the test to obtain relief, you have waived or forfeited that claim. And I think all of this court's waiver and forfeiture jurisprudence, combined with the Minnesota Supreme Court's jurisprudence on that point, demonstrates that that's so. I think the arguments made by appellant in the reply brief as to why that issue isn't waived just are unavailing. Quite frankly, Woodhull, which appellant cites for the prospect that because the state has raised plain error in its brief, the court can decide that case on that basis, doesn't deal with plain error. And that's a different animal. I also question whether the language that appellant relies on in Woodhull would survive later decisions by the Minnesota Supreme Court, especially the reluctance to consider issues not raised by appellants. And it simply does not stand for the proposition that you can make no argument whatsoever on parts of a claim that you have to prove and still obtain relief. Maybe we would be in a different story here if appellant had made some argument about the fourth prong. They haven't, so I don't think we're there. In any event, I take issue with whether the error could be plain under Brown. Brown is one, as Judge Bryan noted, substantially different on its facts. What we have in Brown is a case where we're making a copy of a video that was already received into evidence during the first trial. The notice came very late in the trial, and the Supreme Court noted that the notice to the defense was wholly inadequate. But interestingly enough, under Brown, the Supreme Court still held that the admission of the evidence was not an abuse of discretion. And appellant's reliance upon Brown to establish that the error here would be a plain error is simply unavailing. As to the fairness, I want to get back to that that you've asked about, Judge Bryan. The appellant's entire argument that this was unfair seems to hinge upon the prosecutor's argument in closing argument that the video wasn't of good enough quality to show what the appellant wanted it to show or pointed out it you can't see in the video. That doesn't go to the admissibility of the evidence. It doesn't go to the fairness of admitting.
Mr. Smith, I think to be fair to Ms. Jacks, I think the argument was raised under the context of fairness. So let's assume we're under Brown, and let's assume that we're now deciding whether there was plain error in deciding the fairness aspect of that. And wouldn't it be, I think it's a fair argument for Ms. Jacks to make at that point as it relates to admissibility, because the fairness of it does sort of depend on if the state is saying, rely on this, this video, and then in closing says, well, you can't rely on this video, but you can see the original video based on testimony showed something that the Hoffman body cam video doesn't show. There may be a fairness argument that's appropriate here.
That might be the case if that were the actual record, but I don't read the I certainly don't read the prosecutor saying the officer said that the original video showed blood. I don't think there's any point where the officer testified that the original he saw showed blood, or that the prosecutor argued that the original showed blood. Instead, the prosecutor is saying, well, the video we have doesn't show what appellant is saying because it's not that good a quality. I don't think there was a distinction drawn between the original and the duplicate as to the quality. And I think that goes to the fairness here. And so again, I think under Brown, there's not a substantial question about fairness. One, the authenticity of the original video was never questioned. There's not a distinction drawn by the prosecutor or by a witness as to what the original video showed versus the body camera footage. What we have here, quite frankly, is rank speculation about what went on and why they're about what the authentication evidence would have been. The reason that that the state didn't meet, arguably, according to appellant, the Brown standard, is because the authenticity of the original or the duplicate was never challenged in the district court. This is not a case where we simply had an objection on the fly. There was a motion in limine filed by the defendant that was explicit as to what grounds the appellant was challenging the admission of the evidence on, and that relied entirely upon the rule of completeness and Dolo. The only authority cited in the motion in limine is Dolo. The arguments held on the morning of trial focused on the rule of completeness and Dolo. The appellant had an opportunity to argue authentication that morning, even if it hadn't done so in the written brief and in the written memo. And it had an opportunity to make that argument again when the video was actually offered through Detective Hoffman's testimony. And it never challenged the authenticity of either the original or the duplicate. And in light of that, it shouldn't be surprising that the record is devoid of the kind of evidence Ms. Jax is saying the state must present to authenticate a duplicate. No challenge was made to the authentication of the duplicate. And I would point out that under Rule 1003, a duplicate is assumed admissible unless one of the two conditions set forth in the rule are made.
Mr. Smith, if I could interrupt and ask the same question of you that I did of Ms. Jax, do you think that there's a distinction to be made such that Rule 1003 doesn't apply? This isn't the situation where we're looking at a duplicate, but rather it's akin to someone's testimony about a video or someone's audio recording of a video where you may have play-by-play going on as well.
I don't think so, and I don't think that anyone's certainly argued it under a framework where Rule 1003 doesn't apply. If the rule doesn't apply, certainly then Brown doesn't apply, because Brown is interpreting Rule 1003.
Right, that's what I'm asking, because I think if this isn't a duplicate, and that's a rule that's that is set aside for true duplicates. Then we're just looking at regular authentication. And if you look at the testimony of Hoffman and the other witness as well, now we're looking at a very different question. So that's why I'm asking it. Do you think that Rule 1003 applies? And if you're conceding that it applies, then let us know.
I think there is a reasonable argument that the rule doesn't apply, because the recording has never purported to be anything other than Hoffman's recording made either by the body camera or a camera on his phone. The record wasn't clear on that, at least not the trial record. And it's never purported to be anything other than that. So in this, in this digital world, what constitutes a copy and what constitutes the original is really interesting. And in particular, I want to pick up on this. As I understand Ms. Jack's argument, under Brown, anytime a prosecutor or a police officer would copy a digital recording, say burn it to disk for purposes of disclosure, or download it from a computer in order to preserve it on a flash drive or a DVD or something like that, that would constitute a copy, and you would have to have the testimony that she's arguing has to be made in Brown every time there's a digital copy. The practical implications of that are kind of staggering.
I mean, it's no different than the theoretical possibility that for every piece of evidence, every exhibit, you'd have to have three or four or five or six different chain of custody witnesses. That's a possibility theoretically, but in practice, defense attorneys don't make those kinds of objections very often. But I do think that that's a fair reading of Brown, that it applies just to those situations. And if there's a question, then you would have to you'd have to prove it up.
It may well be a fair reading of Brown, but you're exactly right that there has to be a question posed as to the authenticity. And that hasn't happened here at trial. That simply did not happen. The argument was about completeness. And had there been a challenge about authenticity and Brown was addressed to the district court, then we certainly could have had the hearing, I suppose, that Ms. Jacks thinks we would need to have. And I want to point out that that would also apply to Xeroxing. And we don't do that, at least as a usual course. If the opponent of a duplicate wants to challenge the authenticity, the burden is on them to bring that to the attention of the district court, especially in light of the fact that the rule presumes the admissibility of duplicates. And it doesn't simply say properly authenticated duplicates. The rule doesn't say that. Brown may add that. I do have questions about whether the language that appellant is relying on in Brown is even a binding holding. It's dicta because I think it may well be susceptible to an interpretation that it's dicta because the case was resolved on the abuse of discretion standard. And therefore, particularly the prosecutor should be on notice language is certainly dicta. For all of those reasons, particularly because the defendant has waived the authenticity challenge by not raising or forfeited it by not raising it in the district court, I would ask this court to affirm the district court and appellant's conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Jacks, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Judge Flory. I'd just like to make it clear that on page 6 of our reply brief, we did argue why the interests of fairness and the integrity of judicial proceedings are impacted by the admission of this tape. If the court deems that you're reviewing this under the plein air standard, we cited State versus Saldana for that proposition, as well as State versus Strawman. As to whether we can waive the plein air analysis, as we argued in our reply brief, State versus Woodhull says that issues will be addressed by the appellate courts if the respondent addresses the issue. If you know, we disagree that it was waived, but even if we didn't, it wasn't preserved well enough by the objection below. Under the plain air standard, Brown certainly demonstrates that this was plain air.
Ms. Jacks, what do you make of the predicament that this could place a party in? If there is an exhibit that is offered, there is an opportunity to object, to require certain preliminary testimony that the district court would then need in order to make the preliminary fact findings necessary to admit a document. Let's say that there is no objection at that stage. So you have an absence of that inquiry. There's no preliminary testimony or no evidence sufficient for the district court to have made any preliminary findings that it would have to make had an objection been raised. In that circumstance, on appeal, it's impossible for the moving party, the party, the proponent of the evidence, it's impossible for them at that point in time to now establish or cure whatever the defect might have been. What do you make of what that does to our standard of review?
Yeah, I see your point, Judge Brian, that does place the court in a predicament. A couple of, you know, thoughts on that. And one is, you know, here, the defense did argue that at the hearing, when they were arguing their motion, that the tape wasn't the actual surveillance tape. So we do believe that it was in fact preserved by arguing that it was a duplicate and not the actual surveillance tape. You jump right into Rule 1003, which is titled Admissibility of Duplicates. And so we believe that it was preserved. Furthermore, in this situation, it's sort of like the state wants its cake to eat it too. They want the duplicate to come in and say it's too late and we can't challenge it. Yet in their rebuttal argument, they argue that the tape is of poor quality. So that puts the court in a difficult situation in its standard of review as well.
Are you aware, Ms. Jacks, of anything in the record where the prosecutor at trial suggested that the duplicate or that the original was of better quality? Because the only testimony I saw was the two witnesses who said it was a fair and accurate representation of the original.
That's right. They said it was fair and accurate, Judge Fleury. I know of no other statements about the quality of the tape. What we do know is that the rules prefer the original because the original is presumed to be better than a duplicate, unless, of course, there's a showing that the duplicate was made using a technique that was designed to ensure its accuracy. So, we don't know here what the original would show, but we do know that an objection was made and it was, the duplicate was admitted when, in fact, it is very likely, based on the legal presumptions, that the original was better. I'd encourage the court also, though we didn't argue it today, to look at the rule of completeness argument. There was an abuse of discretion because the judge never ruled on it, and there is knowledge that there was another tape. Both parties acknowledged that the two individuals had fought on a security camera while being videotaped minutes prior to the stabbing. If there are no further questions, we just ask that this court reverse and remand for a new trial, or at a minimum, for a hearing at which there can be some further investigation into the existence of these tapes.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jacks.
Thank you.
And thank you both counsel for your briefing and argument in the matter. It's been helpful to the court. We will now take the matter under advisement.